This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow, President Clinton will sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty at the United Nations. In the early 80s, when we sometimes seemed to be on the brink of nuclear war, Helen Caldicott was one of the best-known anti-nuclear activists. Now she's written an autobiography. It reveals the impact of the activism on her life as a wife and mother and describes some of the behind-the-scenes politics and backstabbing within the peace movement. Caldicott is an Australian pediatrician who gave up medical work to devote herself full-time to anti-nuclear activism. She framed nuclear war as a medical problem, the ultimate epidemic. She lived in the U.S. from 1977 to 86, where she was president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, an organization of 23,000 doctors committed to educating people on the dangers of nuclear weapons and nuclear war. She used to begin her galvanizing speeches by describing what would happen if a nuclear bomb was dropped on the building she was speaking in.
And then I'd describe the concentric circles of destruction, which were first enunciated in a New England Journal of Medicine article in 1962, I think. And so it would depend on the size of the bomb, but I used to use a big one, a 20-megaton bomb equivalent to 20 million tons of TNT, or four times the collective size of all the bombs dropped in the Second World War. And I'd dig the hole 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep and turn everything within that volume to radioactive fallout. And I think 5 miles from the epicenter, everyone would be dreadfully burnt. Many would be vaporized. I used to describe a little boy in Hiroshima who was holding his hand up against the blue sky to catch a red dragonfly, and there was a blinding flash and he disappeared and left his shadow on the pavement behind him. That's what these bombs do. And then out to 20 miles, everyone would be dreadfully burnt. People very far out, 50 or 60 miles, who actually just looked at the flash, as people did in Hiroshima, the heat is so intense their eyes would melt and run down their cheeks, because the eye is a very sensitive, delicate organ. And then I'd say what is left of the buildings would be lying, and what is left of the streets. The families would be separated and many dead. There'd be no physicians, no drugs, no hospitals. And as you lay dying, you'd say to yourself, why on earth did I let this happen? Why didn't I stop it occurring?
Now, why did you take that, very kind of emotional, frightening approach to talking about nuclear weapons?
Because to that point in time, the Pentagon had held sway and used its language, like we do in medicine, use medical language, to obscure the actual facts about what nuclear war meant. And as a physician, I felt obliged to boil this data down into lay language so people could actually understand what nuclear weapons were and how imminent the danger was, and that it would all be over in about an hour. The Russians launch their weapons, they take half an hour to land. Every town and city with a population of 25,000 or more was targeted in this country with at least one bomb, all factories, all military installations, the lot. And then during that half an hour, the American satellite would pick up the attack and their bombs would be launched too, so it would all be over in about an hour. And I thought it was very important to break through people's psychic numbing and sense of denial so that they actually understood what this meant. It's like telling a patient who you've just diagnosed, maybe who has pancreatic carcinoma, to gently help them understand what that meant so they could enter the grief process and work through their grief, hopefully, before they died.
You had an enormous galvanizing effect in America and in your native country, Australia, in mobilizing people against nuclear weapons. In 1983, you resigned under pressure from Physicians for Social Responsibility. What was that about? What was their criticism of you?
Well, we founded it in 1978. It was a totally new organization from the one that first existed in the 60s, which subsequently died. And unfortunately, we used their name. And we, the young people who did this and created such a lively, dynamic, fascinating organization which led the peace movement, I think, in this country, we argued, we fought, but there was so much joy and so much love. And then towards 83, there was a man who was a very good lecturer who I admired, and he wanted to be on the board, which had just been re-elected, and there was no room, so I stood aside as an ex officio member as president, and he took my seat. And it was a bit strange because he didn't thank me. I was off traveling incessantly. I was raising $3 million, half of that for PSR a year and half for WAND, Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament. But I was sort of helping to lead the freeze movement and talking to churches. And I mean, it was huge. But I could feel intuitively that things were not right at home back in Boston. There was stuff going on behind my back, you know, really negative stuff. You pick it up. And I didn't know how to counter it because no one was being honest. So what happened was he actually moved in and started working against me, whether it was jealousy, whether it was sexism, whatever it was. Now, I was not very old. I was late 30s, early 40s. And although I was a leader, I didn't actually realize I was a leader. And I didn't know how to counter negative energy, negativity that you see in all sorts of organizations. I've since learned how to do that.
There was a report, by, I think from an outside consultant that was commissioned by Physicians for Social Responsibility on the leadership of the group. And the report concluded that in any organization's life, a point is reached where a charismatic leader can become overpowering rather than empowering, referring to you.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that conclusion?
No. As we were going through this rather traumatic time, I turned to Bob Scrivener at the Rockefeller Foundation, who'd really been my mentor and who'd funded us enormously. And I said, you know, we're going through this, Bob. He said, look, all organizations go through this. It's a sort of an adolescence. He said, we can get you a management agency. And I said, well, I can't afford that $28,000. He said, we'll pay for it. And I thought that they would investigate it and find out what was going on, you know, and get to the root of the problem. And they wrote a report, much of which I agreed with, but virtually said I should leave PSR. And I was absolutely shattered. And I didn't agree with the conclusions of the report. But by that time, I was losing weight. I was being so affected by the negativity instead of the joy. It was really almost scary. So I eventually resigned, but under duress.
Did you go into hiding, more or less, after you were forced out?
Well, I continued talking. I mean, there was still tremendous demand for me to talk, but I lost the spontaneity and the joy with which I usually talked. And people still kept coming in droves to hear me talk. And I was a bit bitter, I have to say. Mostly because I didn't understand what had happened. And later I did come to understand. If I'm a bit like a dog with a bone, I gnaw on it until I understand the dynamics. And then the whole Nobel Prize thing occurred, which also was very traumatic. And I had nightmares about the thing for years, not myself personally, but about losing the organization, which was at that time so creative. We were on the Today Show, and I was debating with Teller, and I was about to debate with Richard Pearl, although he wimped out at the last minute. All sorts of things. We're having a huge impact on the country. And actually, at the time, the FBI had infiltrated PSR. To this day, I don't know who it was. We got the documents from the FBI, but it was all blacked out. You know, you have if and but and, but there was nothing viable that could be read. And so I have to also wonder if the thing was somewhat orchestrated, because we were taking on the most powerful organizations actually in the world, which were the military-industrial complex at the time, and threatening them enormously.
You kind of had a 1-2 punch in the 1980s, because after you resigned under pressure from Physicians for Social Responsibility, your husband left you.
Yeah, well, we went home in 87 back to Australia, and because I was really, truly burnt out. I could have sustained everything, talking about nuclear war and dreaming about it, but when my colleagues turned against me, I couldn't keep going. So we went home, and I bought an apron symbolically on our trip down to our lovely country house by the sea, thinking now, you know, we'll have the children, we'll have a wonderful family. But it just never happened, and I think Bill was resentful that I'd been away so much. I don't blame him, and I explore that in the book, trying to be honest with myself. And eventually, after 2 years, I think he told me he was leaving me on the eve of my 50th birthday, and that was about the lowest point I reached, I think. That was very difficult to recover from.
Well, how did you handle your period of depression? Did you want nobody, did you want to hide that from everybody else? Did you want to protect your reputation? You know, Helen Caldicott is a strong, powerful woman. She's not allowed to get depressed.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, being in that position, people pedestalize you. They do put you on a pedestal, not knowing your private life and who you are. I can understand that because people need mentors and they sort of need heroes in a way. There aren't a lot except sports people now and film stars. And when you fall off your pedestal and show your feet of clay, they get very disappointed. But we're all fallible and we're all human. I was living by myself in a seaside house by the Pacific Ocean, and it was very beautiful. But I decided not to take any antidepressants because I wanted to work through this myself. I spent many hours in the garden. I had a support group around me, which was wonderful. And a very important thing happened to me about a year and a half after Bill left. You see, I ran around and asked my friends what they thought, looking for an answer, thinking, well, maybe this one will give me the answer. And one day I was working in my garden on a particularly grey day with these black cockatoos circling overhead. We call them funereal cockatoos. And I suddenly realised I'm alone. No one has the answer for me. And then I realised we're born alone and we die alone. And we must find our own way. And that was a very significant turning point where I started to grow.
Well, how did that help you?
Well, I knew I had to find my own answers, and it was almost a relief. And then I did lots of things. I did rebirthing for 10 days, thrashing around on a floor, pretending I was a sperm meeting an egg in the fallopian tube. I did a Buddhist retreat for 10 days, sitting cross-legged on the floor, meditating and not talking. None of these things helped. I did a sweat lodge thing. I did all sorts of things, searching and searching. I'd always felt all my life there was a higher power. I went, as a little girl, I dressed myself up and took myself off to Sunday school and church. My parents were agnostics. I went to the Presbyterian Church, the Catholic Church, the Church of England. I found nothing. Eventually, I just became a cynical scientist and said, prove it to me. But in my search after Bill left, I happened to find a group who lived near me in Byron Bay, a most beautiful part on the north coast of New South Wales. And they persuaded me to do a seminar called Attunement to Soul, S-O-U-L. And I thought, oh, no, not another Californian seminar. But I went, and it did change my life. And I learnt a lot about healing, a different sort of healing from the healing I'd been taught as a medical student and a doctor, about energetic healing. And it changed me. I felt different. I felt more peaceful. I felt more joy than I'd ever felt before. And I had some wonderful experiences, including an almost burning bush experience in nature, so that I now know there's something beyond me. I thought, well, I'd never find that. You know, gurus would and others would, but I would never know. But I did, and I feel so privileged, and it healed me, and I'm really a different person now.
What was your burning bush experience?
Well, I knew you'd ask that, and I've never talked about it, and I actually don't think I will at this time. I may write
a book about it
called The Sacred Art of Healing, but I'm not quite ready to talk about that yet. But it was very, very powerful.
My guest is physician and anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott. She's written a memoir called A Desperate Passion. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with physician and anti-nuclear activist Helen Caldicott. You know, I'm wondering, the years that you were crusading against nuclear weapons, you were very busy worrying about one of the world's biggest problems. Did that mean that you weren't spending much time thinking about your own personal situation? And when you were speaking less about the world's problems, did all your own little problems kind of team up and fight back?
It's a good point. Obviously, I wasn't home much, and Bill was resentful. I had three teenage children, and the one who most resented it was my daughter, my beautiful daughter, Penny. Now, you know, whether you're a good parent or bad parent, all kids rebel in adolescence, and Penny did. And she spent a lot of time with Bill, talking to Bill and became very close to him, and I wasn't there a lot. And she still has feelings about this, although we're very close now and about to build two houses next door to each other so I can be near my grandchildren, which is a joy. So I missed out on my children. I had a dilemma. Should I stay at home and bake cakes for them and be there when they got home from school? Yes, I should have. Or should I go out and make sure my children had a relatively safe future, and I opted for the latter and missed the former?
I think, you know, for anybody who has children, it's a really hard choice how much time to devote to work and how much time to make sure you're home with the family. Perhaps even harder for a woman because the, you know, the traditional role of the woman is the person at home. You know, in rethinking the equation that you came up with between work and family, would you change it if you could go back?
When Bill left me, and I was so absolutely devastated. I remember I visited Boston on a speaking trip, and I was interviewed by the Boston Globe, and I said that all this work has been ashes in my mouth, that I should never have done it because I've lost a marriage, and for me, marriage is sacrosanct. It's archetypal. The family is a very significant, deeply psychological symbol. And I think that was partly why I was so devastated. However, as I recovered spiritually and psychologically from this, I realized that I could not have done it, that almost it was written on the blueprint of my soul, that I was impelled to do it. I could feel the heat of the bombs. I knew what was going to happen. My intuition was accurate, and I had to act on that. And that I was almost born to do this. I'm not saying this with an arrogance. I'm just saying that that's what I feel.
I want to get back to nuclear weapons. The Cold War, which was still raging when you started speaking out against nuclear weapons, is over. The General Assembly just endorsed a treaty that would end nuclear weapons testing. Do you feel, looking back, that nuclear war really wasn't on the verge of happening after all? Or do you feel that it's in part because of the work of that you did and that people like you did that the Cold War ended and we have a treaty in the works?
No, I think it's the latter. I spent an hour and a quarter with President Reagan in 83 in the White House downstairs library talking about nuclear weapons, and his knowledge was minimal, if not zero. He quoted to me from the Reader's Digest, which he called his intelligence files. I'd just written Missile Envy, and I had all the data at my fingertips. He wasn't very bright clinically. It was a very alarming meeting, and yet he had the football at his disposal, the nuclear codes. Soon after that, he was using this belligerent rhetoric of the evil empire, and we had to prepare ourselves for nuclear war and the like. There was a NATO exercise where NATO, really America, was buzzing Soviet nuclear facilities in Eastern Europe. And there was a double KGB CIA agent in London who heard that unless the exercise was called off within 5 hours, the Soviet Union was going to strike a nuclear strike against America. He contacted Thatcher, who called Reagan in the middle of the night and woke him up and said, unless the exercise is aborted, there will be a nuclear strike within hours, and it was aborted. That man subsequently was excommunicated from Russia, from his family, and when Gorbachev got into power, he came back. I was on a radio show on Monday recently in Washington where a man called up and said, yes, I was involved in that. It was indeed a terrifying time.
What do you consider the greatest impact of your work as an anti-nuclear activist?
I believe, and it's not just my work, Terry, it's the work of millions of people, not just in this country, and the church's wonderful dedicated people, but throughout the world, and of course Gorbachev. I believe the greatest miracle of this century is that the Cold War ended. I never believed, as I struggled round like the anti-nuclear bag lady round this country and the world, I never in my heart of hearts, I would never have said it. I never believed the Cold War would end. The belligerence, the antagonism was so profound that I would stagger off the stage trembling by people's animosity when I said we have to learn to live with the Russians. Russian flesh burns at the same temperature as American flesh. They're our brothers and sisters. I never thought it would happen. But, you know, it's happened, and I don't think we've given ourselves enough credit for it, nor really understand the true significance of that.
You started off professionally as a pediatrician, and you've often said that you changed from pediatrician to anti-nuclear activist because you decided instead of saving a few children, you'd be better off saving all children by trying to prevent a nuclear war. When the Cold War ended, did you think, maybe I'll return to being a pediatrician now?
I still think that. I miss medicine enormously. I absolutely love it. And I think maybe I'll go and retrain back in Australia and work with my daughter, who's a general practitioner in an all-female practice. I'd love to do that. Yet the risk has not gone. The CTB, Complete Test Ban Treaty, was passed by the United Nations. Meanwhile, the scientists in America, Los Alamos, Lawrence Livermore and the like, are planning and designing a new generation of nuclear weapons. They are continuing subcritical testing, blowing up plutonium in the desert in Nevada, have huge computers in hand to test, to build and design more sophisticated nuclear weapons. This country still has at least 15,000 weapons when 1,000 could induce nuclear winter and the end of all life on Earth. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is in Russia decommissioning the Russian weapons. So now is the time that America could rise to its full moral and spiritual height. Could, with Russia, disarm both countries simultaneously within 5 years, abolish nuclear weapons, then it would have the full moral force to say to France, to China, and to England, and to Israel, okay, that's it. All weapons are to be dismantled, and then that'll be it. Yeah, there'll be terrorist bombs, for sure. There'll be a few rogue nations that build their weapons, but we won't still be living under the threat of nuclear annihilation. If that doesn't happen, I predict within 10 years, at least 20 countries will have built their own nuclear weapons. So we're really at the crossroads of time, Terry.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Helen Caldicott's new autobiography is called A Desperate Passion. She now divides her time between Australia and the U.S. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.